Welcome to Big Blend Radio's Military Monday Show with Mike Guardia, award-winning author and historian. Welcome back, everybody. Today, we've got Mike Guardia, of course. You know, it is our first Monday show here on Big Blend Radio, always focused on military history. And today is a very interesting show. We're going to be talking about the Oklahoma City bombing. We're looking at, you know, this is April, and the bombing happened on April 19th, 1995, the Oklahoma City bombing. It was a domestic terrorist attack, really, when you think about that. It was pretty big when you think of September 11th. This was the largest one before September 11th, and so many people were killed. I believe 168 people were killed, over 680 injured, and one-third of the building, which they blew up, is now actually part of what is the Oklahoma City National Memorial, which is on our National Park Service. So welcome back, Mike. How are you?
Hey, Lisa. I'm doing very well. Always a pleasure to be on the show.
You know, this is a tough story to tell because it's domestic terrorism, something that I think our country, you know, never thought would really happen, right? And terrorism also, of course, when we look at September 11th, that was it was domestic terrorism in that something happened on our soil. But this was a terrorism attack in regards to people from our country, which is a little different, right?
Right.
Okay. And so this is something also that you talked about on the History Channel. Tell everybody about that show that you're on, so people know, like, you know, with reruns and maybe some possible upcoming new appearances.
Of course. Right. So this was last year, and I was a featured historian on season one of a new documentary series on the History Channel called I Was There. And it has a very similar premise in some form or fashion to Quantum Leap, where you have the host who is dropped into the middle of all of these historical events. And instead of it taking a fictional bent like it did with Quantum Leap, he's actually explaining and he's narrating and he's interacting with the audience and the viewers to say, this is what happened, and this is why it is such a critical point in the history of the world. And as he is taking the viewer through all of these bits and pieces of these historical events, it's interspersed with both voiceovers and camera appearances from any number of historians who are recognized experts in that field. And I was featured in season one for a handful of episodes. And one of the episodes that I interviewed for was the one on the Oklahoma City bombing. And you can still see season one. It is still on the History Channel. Any one of your viewers can queue it up on demand. It's also on Amazon Prime, if you prefer to see it on your personal device. And it was probably one of the most somber episodes that I did as part of that series, because you're not only dealing with a bout of domestic terrorism, but this was also someone who, by all outward appearances, you would never expect to become radicalized in the manner that he did, and to perpetrate the crime on the level that he did. You know, this was not only someone who was an American-born American citizen, he was also a distinguished veteran of Desert Storm. You know, here he was, a decorated veteran, and barely 4 years out from that conflict, you know, he becomes radicalized to the point where he is convinced that the U.S. government is the ultimate evil in the world, and the only way for him to right the wrongs that the government has committed is for him to blow up this random federal building in the middle of Oklahoma City. So when you wrap your head around it and you follow the story arc, it really is tragic. And the only thing that you can really take away from it is that, you know, society will always produce its own monsters. And sometimes, no matter what you do or what you don't do, somebody out there is going to have an axe to grind, and you just have to do the best you can to try to stop them before they pull the trigger, whether that's the trigger of a gun or a detonator that they use to blow up a building.
What's kind of freaky is he also had a partner in crime, right? It wasn't just him.
He did.
And he also had all these other plans on top of this bombing that happened. And these were innocent people, but it was a federal building, right? And so this was a federal attack, but he was really against all these other things. Like he wanted to go after the FBI dude, and he wanted to go, he wanted to go after specific people that didn't. This is what I find very interesting in how history repeats itself is I also look at what happened with, the raid on the Capitol on January 6th. That was more of like a mob mentality, but it was still radicalization in a way and extremism, right? I look at Charlottesville in Virginia. That's that same kind of attitude. When we get that incensed, when things aren't going with your own belief system, that you will act out that way. So we kind of lose, human beings will lose, and I'm not saying we as in me, man, hell no. We lose our sensibilities at some point. So, and with him being a decorated veteran and then also having his friend being one too, right? Wasn't he a veteran too, both of them?
So his two main accomplices were Terry Nichols and Michael Fortier, and they were also veterans. As a matter of fact, they met Tim McVeigh in the military while they were all in basic training together, and they all came from backgrounds where they were not necessarily troubled youths, but they tended to be targets of bullying more than most kids are. And at some point, I think each of them got initially radicalized, not to an extreme point, but they became very hardened in the sense that they started gravitating towards what we now know today are the militia movements, and they were very pro Second Amendment. They were very much against any type of gun control, and they all started to believe that the frontier militiaman way of life was really the way to go, and they were very distrustful of any type of government oversight or any type of government intervention. And they were that's when they all started to that's when they all started to coalesce, I think, around the whole concept of the militia movement. And one of the texts, oddly enough, that became a flashpoint for all three of those boys was a book that has now been banned in many states. It w was a book called The Turner Diaries. And The Turner Diaries was a work of fiction, but it spoke, and I know I'm oversimplifying the plot when I say this, but it spoke of a right-wing radical pro-gun militia that whose founders activated all these cells, and they rose up against the government, and there was actually a race war that happened throughout the course of that book. Well, after the Oklahoma City bombing happened, they pretty much took a look at what was within the pages of the Turner Diaries. I know that Tim McVeigh, at some point during his incarceration, had mentioned that as one of his inspirational texts. Well, if you look at it, you really find points throughout the narrative that created a blueprint for what we now know today as the Oklahoma City bombing.
So this is what really got him. Do you think if he was, so was he reading this while he was, fighting for freedom? Think about this. I mean, him being part of Desert Storm, going off, he's a decorated veteran. He fought in war. Do you think he was reading that during that time? And when you're in that place of war, I mean, You are in a warrior position, right? As a soldier, you're in survival mode, but kill mode, period, right? There's, that's the way it is, right? And so at that point, that is all very realistic and accessible in a way. If you were living in suburbia land and Beaver Cleaver neighborhood, that may not seem so realistic, but then we know things like that do happen in Beaver Cleaver land, right? So we
Right, we
know
do.
you never know what's going on. But do you think this started from his home front? Like, when you were researching him, did you see where his past before he got to this position where, he just decided, hey, I'm going to blow up this building because I believe I'm right over everyone. Yeah, and everyone, we're talking about Timothy McVeigh. We didn't really want to give his name out. Like, yeah, we all know, but we're not praising him. Let's put it that way. And I don't want people to listen to this podcast thinking, ooh, let's, radicalize some more. This is to show what not to do, right, Mike? Just saying. Yeah. So what do you think was the mindset? I mean, do you think he was raised with parents that were anti? I mean, there's anti-government and in regards to, hey, we think the government spent so much money, right? In political drama, but this is a little, quite a bit more than that.
It is, so he actually didn't get he didn't get his hands on a copy of the Turner Diaries until he was actually in the military. But if you look at, I think, the latter part of his formative years, you really start to see the seeds being planted of how he became radicalized. Because if you take a look at his early childhood, there's really nothing that stands out as a red flag to anybody. I mean, here was your all-American kid who was, he was quiet. He was kind of shy. He was n not a troublemaker by any stretch. And he really didn't gravitate towards a lot of team sports. And the few sports that he did play, he wasn't beyond what you would call an average athlete. And then, of course, by the mid 1980s, this is the rise of the PC, the personal computer industry, and that really starts taking off. So he starts getting into that. He
Oh,
spends a
yeah.
lot of he spends a lot of time on his Commodore 64. And again, so far so good. Nothing to me that stands out as a red flag. But then you have his formative high school years, which, he describes as hell. He describes that there were a lot of the so-called jocks spent a lot of time bullying him, that he didn't really know how to talk to girls in any form or fashion, and spent most of his time wishing that he was stronger and more powerful than he was at the time. When he sees the injustices being perpetrated against him in high school, this is, I think, really where the seed gets planted for his latter day radicalism. Now, we fast forward to right after he's graduated, and he starts to take an immense interest in firearms. And he becomes very, very adamant about gun rights. He becomes very pro Second Amendment. And he starts reading a lot of these magazines like Soldier of Fortune and Gun Week, and he develops, I think, what can be called a very intense fascination, almost a borderline obsession with all things firearms.
Oh.
And after a small stint as working a small stint working as a guard and driver for an armored car company, he decides that he wants to enlist in the military. So he enlists at the age of 20. This is the spring of 1988, and he goes off to basic and AIT for to be an infantryman, the MOS we call 11 Bravo. And he takes basic training, takes all of his infantry training at what was then Fort Benning, is now Fort Moore, and that's where he meets Terry Nichols and Michael Fortier. And this was probably a perfect storm if ever there was one, because you have these guys who come from all these similar backgrounds. They are very much into reading the same literature like Soldier of Fortune, Gun Week. They're all very much into firearms. And that's when Tim McVeigh gets his hands on a copy of the Turner Diaries. And despite the fact that he is becoming very radicalized and developing a bit of an unhealthy attachment, to firearms, he is still a model soldier. And when he's assigned to Fort Riley, he rises pretty high in the ranks, when you take it as a function of the time that he had been in service. Because here we are, by the spring of 1991, he's only been in the service for about 3 years now, and he's already a buck sergeant. So he's doing very well for himself, and he's showing a lot of proficiency in his soldiering tasks. He's assigned to the 1st Infantry Division, which, for all your listeners out there, that is a mechanized infantry division, which means that instead of doing everything purely on foot, the infantrymen board these mechanized infantry fighting vehicles that take them into battle, and then they dismount from those vehicles, and then they fight dismounted. Well, McVeigh, at this point, he is a gunner on one of these Bradley fighting vehicles. Its main gun is this 25-millimeter gun, and he's the top scoring gunner in his unit. And he's doing so well that when the storm kicks off, there is little doubt that he is going to be an asset to the organization, and he's going to kill the enemy, and he's going to kill them very effectively. Well, he goes off to Iraq. He fights he fights throughout Desert Storm. He's right there on the front lines with the 1st Infantry Division, and he at one point claims to, and there are actually some service records that help to corroborate this. He claims to have gotten a shot off from 1,100 yards, where he shot an Iraqi dismounted soldier. Now, from 1,100 yards, that's a considerable distance, but he got the soldier dead center, and it was a headshot that actually decapitated the enemy troop.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so that of course became a that of course became a top story. That was the big piece of juicy gossip that got tossed around the unit. Oh, hey, you hear about that awesome kill shot that McVeigh got? And he's feeling pretty good about himself. Now, this is where the story takes on a little bit of a contradictory tone. I mean, he's very pumped to be in the middle of a war, to be fighting in this action, but then he sees the carnage that happened on the Highway of Death. All those Iraqi troops who were escaping from Kuwait City, and Allied aircraft strafed that escape column. So he says that when he saw the carnage that was on the road that we now know today as the Highway of Death, he said that that's what shocked him, and that he began to think at that point that the U.S. government was more of a bully than a force for good. So yeah, how exactly he comes to that conclusion, I'm not entirely sure. I mean, this is war, and it's never pretty, it's never poetic. It's always just something that is terrible, but sometimes it needs to be done. So he tucks that in the back of his mind for a little bit anyway. Then he comes back, and this is where I think he made a fatal mistake in terms of his mental health, because he just redeploys from being in the desert for the better part of 8 to 10 months. And then, instead of taking some much needed rest and recuperation, instead of taking a good time to focus on his mental health and decompress from the horrors of combat, he says, okay, well, I've just redeployed to the US. Instead of taking an investment in my mental health and decompressing from combat, let me sign up for special forces training right away. You really can't.
Damn.
Now, knowing today what we know about the importance of maintaining mental health and all of the mental health apparatuses that the Army,
Yeah.
the entire Defense Department has, we know that that is not something you do, that that is just not a good idea. You don't go from the frying pan and jump into the fire. So he decides he wants to sign up to be a wants to sign up to be a Green Beret, and he withdrew from the course on the second day of training, for what he initially described as an ankle injury. And I'm sure that was true, but the fact that he really just hadn't given himself enough time to unwind from the horrors of combat, it really just sent him over the edge. He never really psychologically recovered from washing out of the Special Forces selection. And it messed with him to a point where he said, you know what, I really don't want to be in the Army anymore. So, here he is, this decorated war hero, who gets honorably discharged the same year that he comes home from Desert Storm. So he comes home and he's living in upstate New York at this point, and he's trying to make sense out of where he is in life and what he can do to try to better his situation. So he kind of just sits at home and doesn't do a whole lot. But as 1992 gets underway, that's when he starts writing all of these op-eds to the local papers, and even starts writing to his congressman, saying that taxes are evil and that they shouldn't exist, and saying that
Whoa.
and saying that the Second Amendment needs to be taken seriously and that there should be no gun control. And then what happens that is a flashpoint for him, and a flashpoint for a lot of others within the greater militia movement here in the US, is the 1993 siege on the Branch Davidian compounds in Waco. Now, I vaguely remember that. I was still in grade school at the time, and I lived in Houston, which was a little south of Waco. So, I mean, I remember. So I remember the media frenzy that happened around it. And what struck me is that you had FBI agents who somehow got hold of armored vehicles that they were using to plow down the gates and to cave in the walls of this Branch Davidian compound. Well, this standoff between the Branch Davidians and the FBI, it went on for a while, and it attracted a lot of local and national attention.
And this is
And
Ruby Ridge, right? Ruby Ridge. This is,
well, Ruby Ridge happens a little bit later.
oh, okay. I'm just trying to get my bearings here. Okay. So this is what moved towards it. Okay. All right. So, okay.
And Tim McVeigh, of all people, he went down there to try to get a front row seat to it. And he was very much on the side of the Branch Davidians. And he took his car down there, and off of the hood of his car, he was selling these bumper stickers. These bumper stickers would say things like, "If the government outlaws guns, I will become an outlaw." And a lot of these, a lot
I
of
think you're
these,
already an outlaw when you're doing
right?
that.
So he is selling a lot of these pro gun right pamphlets and these pro gun right bumper stickers. And and he's making no effort to conceal his feelings that he thinks that the government is clearly in the wrong. And as a matter of fact, there was a local reporter through one of the local stations down there that interviewed him on site. And of course, that footage it got dug up 2 years later when the Oklahoma City bombing happened. But he says that he says that he truly thinks that the government's in the wrong. And that this violent, antagonistic government is not what the founding fathers envisioned. So we fast forward a little bit later, and another flashpoint for him is Ruby Ridge. That was the standoff between the Weaver family and all of the federal agents. And that for all it's worth, was the final straw for McVeigh to say, okay, well, I saw the government push people around when I was in Iraq, and I see them doing it to everyday citizens. You know what? I think that I think that the government is full of these fascist tyrants, and that these federal agents are nothing more than glorified stormtroopers. So what he did at that point was that's when he started to plot his quote unquote revenge against the federal government, and said, okay, well, I need to pick a target, and I need to pick one that I know is going to be easily accessible, but if I do enough damage, it's definitely going to get somebody's attention. So he goes through with it, yeah.
I just wanted to backtrack here. You know, here he is very pro gun rights, and there's a lot of America that is. So, you know, we were laughing, oh, you're an outlaw doing stickers. So there's a lot of people doing stickers and stuff, but there's, when you see all this history with him, like you can, there's signs, and there's political stuff, right? And views. And, you know, I mean, we're going through the same thing. I mean, I just find this story so re just weirdly real for today's climate. Of, you know, people get really riled up about stuff, but like this dude is now going to the extreme, right? So we've got to look at, hey, we believe this about, you know, automatic weapons versus this weapon versus, you know, do we need AK-47s in the street? I don't know. I grew up with those being, you know, around in places that you didn't want. So, you know, everybody's got different views. And it's okay to debate them, have all that, but this is a little bit of a step in a where you become incensed. And we see people now today becoming absolutely incensed on all sides politically. I'm not taking any sides on them. I'm completely independent, as people may know, or may we get accused of being different political parties all the time. And that's the problem. A party to me is with friends. Politics. So it's kind of interesting. So do you think he was even like in a political party, but he was like in an extreme militia? I mean, we've heard about these kind of, you know, these groups that are like, I mean, it's happening to this. They're here now. This is real, right? Mike, when we talk about this, this is not, there's more than one Tim McVeigh out there, is what I'm getting to about this. So you can't, some of your neighbors may believe, hey, listen, I've got this. I go hunting, I want this gun, you know, versus you know what I'm saying on this whole issue. So it's not lightly, and I'm not going to get into a political drama, but it's kind of weird right now when you think about what we're going through in this country that happened over what, almost, God, over 20 years ago, right? This is so would you say some of that was a warning sign? But we can't keep looking at every neighbor going, that's a warning sign, because Tim did that, you know? So it's kind of hard to track unless you were just watching him 100% that these were all signs. You know what I mean? Because he was kind of flying under the radar to this point. Then we'll get to Ruby Ridge. But do you think at this time, all these different things you're saying about, like, here's a sign, here's a sign, all these red flags, they don't appear as a red flag until you bunch them all together at the end. But it, so he's able to fly under the radar at this point, right? Even going to these rallies and whatever, that would be a normal thing? Or do we now look differently, do you think?
Well, I think we look a little bit differently now, just as a function of our hindsight. I think that I think that whenever we see things like that, we tend to pay a little bit more attention to it. Maybe somebody reports it, maybe they don't, or maybe somebody just looks upon it a little bit differently. And this can take a wide context and cast a wide net for a lot of different situations. I mean, like if I think of what happened in the late 90s, I think about the Columbine shooting, and I think back to the big national narrative that happened in the aftermath of that tragedy, and people racking their heads saying, okay, well, what things did we miss? Were there any red flags that we should have seen, but we didn't? And what were some of the behavioral warning signs that either of these two perpetrators gave off prior to them doing what they did? And when we took it all together, we said, okay, well, going forward now, every school administrator, every teacher, every classroom, really, for that matter, should be told, it's like, hey, if you see something that looks like this, even if it's nothing, go ahead and say something, because if it turns out to be nothing, well, then okay. But
Great.
if it does, you can say, hey, well, good thing I erred on the side of caution, because I can still remember very vaguely throughout the early and mid 90s that if kids in some of the younger grades would ever make any kind of threat of violence, it was usually taken as a sign of jest, or maybe said something just to induce a lot of shock effect, like, hey buddy, you better not do that, or I'm gonna kick your butt, or man, I'm gonna kill you. It's like no one saw it more as just, maybe two guys or even two girls, just blustering and, maybe just trying to prove how tough they are. But it really wouldn't go into the realm of producing a fatality. I can tell that the culture changed after Columbine because, well, then you had a much greater crackdown on anything that could even be remotely construed as violent or could precipitate any type of a school shooting. So.
And at that point, then we have idiots like, what's was his name, Alex Jones, that idiot
Yeah.
that you have people. I mean, America's very interesting to me, having been raised in in South Africa in my teen years, and also lived in England and Kenya before that. I was always used to, we've talked about this on shows before, obviously, but safety, security, AK-47s, limpet mines, all that. You go through security checks and coming to this country, I thought this country was like a free-for-all for any terrorist. So terrorism, and domestic terrorism was what I was raised with. And so I didn't quite get it until we're actually doing this, that that's what Nancy and I always talk about. Yeah, that was domestic terrorism, because we always talk about terrorists, and I think Ireland feels like that too, in some ways. There's always that kind of conversation against each other, but and so this country, I remember feeling very unsafe when we first got here, and I remember listening to the radio, because I forget, we all listen to the radio, it's a thing, and it was when it first got here, and it scared. Like scared me. I went running to Nancy the next morning. I said, Nancy, what are we doing here? We left South Africa with everything going off, and we are passport Americans, born here, and it was time for us to come home because everything was crazy at the time. And she had a magazine, and the world was going nuts, and people were taking over media and all that. And it was time to come home until things died down. And I listened to the radio this one night and found, I don't know, I didn't know the difference between what was going on the AM and the FM channel. It was some militia group, just like what we're talking about. And they were talking about, getting guns, doing stuff. Like, it freaked me out. Like, I'm going, you're openly saying this because you don't openly talk that way. Like, you don't dare, But they were like, there was, I don't know what channel I got on. And then I also got the one with Art Bell, and I thought, dude, we're all beaming up. I was like, what is going on tonight, man? I didn't know what was happening in this country, and it scared the absolute, stuff out of me, because I was like, where did we just land? And the first thing we watched on TV was the first morning we woke up. Everything is TV centric in this country. And we got here and we're like, what? Turn the TV on, and they had talk shows, and people were fighting on talk shows like Jerry Springer style, but it wasn't Jerry Springer yet. It was still, before that. And I was in absolute shock and horror that they would have this on, that would be banned where I came from, right? And I was like, what are we doing? And so that's kind of interesting to me, because coming here and talking to people, and everybody thought Nancy and I were weird. Going like, you're so open to being bombed and things, and people look at us weird, but that is true, actually. And September 11th happened, and And I like it, everybody was floored, and it was a horrible, horrible, devastating thing that happened. What Timothy McVeigh did in his court is horrible and devastating, but these things do happen, and I feel like it is part of exactly what you're talking about, going back to the Columbine shootings and people like Alex Jones, what an idiot. You know, to screw around with that kind of conversation, what happens on media, it's very important. I mean, even doing this show scares me because I don't want anyone to think we're giving life to this man or person who killed so many people, 168 people. And it devastates the ripple effect of families, you know, the injured, the PTSD that comes from this for anybody around that. I mean, it's huge. So, you know, to give life force to these kind of people is not something we like to do. But it's an important thing to look at Americans not being aware, is my point, aware of what's going on. And now that we're in the age of cell phones and everybody's stuck to their phone on games and all kinds of, you know, stupid stuff and good stuff too. Good stuff too. I just feel that this conversation is actually more important than we may have thought of getting on to this call today. Because if we don't get to know who our neighbor is, I think these things slip through the cracks. And I think Timothy McVeigh, as you were talking about one side after the other, I'm like, these are all normal signs, but not like, but when you group them together, oh hell, right? So let's go back to the Ruby Ridge. But did anybody at this point, before the Ruby Ridge, listen, and why did they have to call Ruby Ridge? We're not in Kansas. Sorry, I was just thinking about Ruby Ridge slippers. But when everybody got to this point, did anybody kind of suspect him at all? In any evidence, anybody kind of raise voice, or did he all these red flags just get shuffled under as like a normal person?
Well, any of his accomplices and, the friends and relatives of those accomplices, I mean, some of them knew what was going on, but nobody thought to come forward. And one of them even said that he was afraid of McVeigh and, thought that, oh gosh, if I say anything, then instead of blowing up the building, he's going to blow up me. But he was able to at least get enough of the big red flags under the radar to where it didn't arouse too much suspicion. I mean, if we go back and we look at the story arc of what he's doing from the time of Ruby Ridge and the assault on Waco until he actually parks the truck bomb in front of that federal building, he has a few close calls with people who are, raising eyebrows at what the heck is this guy doing, but none of them really put the pieces of the puzzle together to say, okay, well, this is something that we should definitely look into.
It's amazing, isn't it? So tell everybody what happened into. See, but that's the thing. I think now we have to say something. And I wonder if people just are. Is this a weird thing now too? Because we're so politically correct too. So we speak up, but then we don't want people to feel, you know what I mean? We're very polite society, but not. It's a weird time, huh?
It is.
We have to have the pronoun correct if we're going to accuse somebody. You know, I'm not knocking the pronouns. I'm just saying that there's got to be this, you know, because I know someone's going to complain now. But the reality is, fine. We want everyone to be happy, but you do have to call something out. You do. You do. You do, because you can save so many lives. If somebody called out Tim McVeigh, 168 people would still be alive. So, and you know, that's a huge deal. So Ruby Ridge, let's go back down to Ruby Ridge. What went down that day?
So this was in the late summer of 92, and they of course being the US Marshals, they had actually descended onto some land that was owned by the Weaver family. This was in Boundary County, Idaho, and they were They'd come to serve a bench warrant on Randy Weaver. And Weaver was a guy who had been in trouble for, well, a lot of things. But they had come to serve a bench warrant on him. And Weaver, of course, being the very pro Second Amendment, pro survivalist that he was also a white separatist, and was
Sure.
all about white supremacy. Yeah, he said, well, hey, I'm not going down without a fight. I don't care if you're a federal agent, a U.S. Marshal, or whoever you are. You are not going to set one foot on my land, and I'm not going to give it up without a fight. So, this was an armed resistance that happened, and shots were fired, shots exchanged, and at the end of the at the end of the event, the U.S. Marshals had the U.S. Marshals and the FBI had stormed the property that Weaver had up there in the wilderness. And it was national news, and the breaking headlines that we saw across the country was, there was a was that there was a gunfight between these privately armed separatist citizens and several agents of the U.S. government. So that, of course, becomes another big flashpoint for the militia movement here in America. A lot of the separatists, a lot of the very militant pro-gun rights crowds take this as a take this as a clarion call almost to say, hey, look, this is what our government is capable of doing, and if they're doing this, well, are they qualitatively any better than the redcoats that we threw off over 200 years ago?
Wow. Wow. And you think about now, these militant groups are still out there, and we have the Nazi groups. Like, it's almost like on a rise again. KKK being part of it too. I mean, it's all like the same kind of people, right? And so, and the survivalist mode. So I understand people worried about, like, hey, climate change. Well, listen, you're big barrel of peanut butter is not going to help you in climate change, but they think like we can live in a cave. And this is this the same kind of thing? I mean, I know some people are survivalists, and there's things to be worried about in climate change and hurricanes and blizzards and all that kind of stuff, and have supplies. But are we kind of on the same line? I mean, where does the line go? Is there a line? I mean, it seems very blurry, but people being worried, listening to whatever kind of stuff, I mean, happens on the news to, like, we need, remember Y2K? Everybody thinking the world's gonna have a huge, it's gonna be World War III. And I'm going, hey man, this is gonna be cool. We can all go back to farming and stuff. It's gonna be cool. We can grow a garden. Look at it now, right? 24 years later, look at where we are now. Amazing. And all those crazy things. So this is where conspiracy can go crazy. And do you think Timothy McVeigh was really a subject of believing conspiracy to the nth? And because he's got this training, understands how to kill, he it's now part, of course, of his life, with this kind of, I'm not being political, please. I'm just saying people, there are weird conspiracies. Some of them are true. There's some weird ones out there that turn out right down the road. But then there's the ones that are complete, like cause wars. And this would be one, I think, that he kind of tagged into that guy's book and off he goes, and believes it. It's almost like a cult, honestly.
It
This whole
is.
militia thing, it sounds like there's the cults where everybody's doing hippy dippy stuff, and then there's the cults, here we're gonna, whatever stuff, the weird stuff, the woo woo culty stuff, and then this is of the bipolar opposite of the woo woo cult, but it's like we're a cult with guns. That's how it feels to me with this. So I kind of feel like he was in that water, and so the people that, I mean, did the FBI and everybody look at the people he was associated with beyond the immediate people, like beyond that, those, these people that were, I mean, were they able to tap into this network of others?
Well, they did after the fact. And the thing is that even though Tim McVeigh drew a lot of inspiration from it, and he closely identified with the same values, there was no conclusive record to show that he actually had a membership in any one of the militias. But if you take a look at what McVeigh has written down and all the things that he said when he was still living, you really see that those two draw so many parallels from one another. And if they're adopting similar mindsets, there's a very big reason why the authorities need to keep an eye on them.
Oh, it's amazing, man. So, how did they get him?
Well, it was kind of a comedy of errors. There was a very good documentary that was put out not too long ago, and from what I recall, this documentary was a companion piece to a book that also came out. It was called The McVeigh Tapes, and right before, I think it was about a year before McVeigh's execution, there was an author who got to sit down with him in prison and just get the full story from McVeigh, and he preserved all the tapes, and the tapes you can actually hear the audio as part of the documentary. But he tells the story about what he was doing, how he was planning it, and especially how he got caught. And this is one of the things in the story
Wow.
that I've never quite made a lot of sense out of, because for a guy who goes on the record in the same interview to say that he did what he did because he hated the US government and thought that they were the ultimate bullies and that they needed to pay, he said he set up his escape in a way that guaranteed he would be caught and guaranteed that he would be executed. And he said this, and I'll never forget it. He said, "I did this as the ultimate form of state-assisted suicide." And I'm thinking,
Oh
okay,
my God.
a glorified suicide by cop. So yeah, and because and here's how he here, here's how he explains it. Here are all the events of the narrative following his escape attempt and how he was caught. There was a 1977 Mercury Marquis that he parked only about a block or two away from the Alfred P. Murrah building in Oklahoma City. So once he parked the truck bomb, got out of the cab, turned a few corners, and the bomb went off, of course, but he kept on walking, and got into the driver's seat of the 77 Mercury, and then he just took off north up on the interstate. Well, the thing is that this Mercury Marquis, it was his, right? But he didn't have any license plates on it. So you're driving
Oh.
without a license plate, sooner or later, a cop's going to notice and they're going to want to pull you over. So he's a few miles north of Oklahoma City at this point, and I think it's either a sheriff's deputy or an Oklahoma state trooper that sees, hey, there's this car on the interstate, doesn't have any plates on it, so pulls him over, and realizes, of course, that this car does not have a registration. McVeigh confesses to the officer that he has a gun on him, and of course McVeigh is taken into custody, taken to the local jail. All this time, they have no idea that the guy in custody is the same guy who just blew up the federal
No.
building in Oklahoma City. Yeah, and it's I think it's about 2 or 3 days, something like that, where they finally put two and two together, and he has a federal agent come down to the jailhouse and say, "You're the guy we've been looking for." So he's transferred into federal custody at that point, and that's when we got the iconic image of McVeigh being led out of the courthouse in that orange jumpsuit that just has this just icy cold look of death over his face. And
Wow.
yeah, it's incredible. And to kind of put an ironic twist on the end of that story, there's a there's somewhat of a personal connection there, because years after this happened, and oddly enough, when I was working on my research for The Fires of Babylon, that story of Eagle Troop and the Battle of 73 Easting, One of the soldiers whom I spoke with a lot, and I think provided probably the best color commentary from the book, was Chris Hedenskog. He was McMaster's driver at the battle. And Hedenskog, oddly enough, Hedenskog got out of the army at around the same time that McVeigh did. And as a matter of fact, he and McVeigh are almost the same age. He got out of the army at around the same time McVeigh did. Hedenskog comes back to the States. Enrolls at the University of Denver. And his first job out of college is with the Federal Bureau of Prisons. And one of the very first prisoners that Chris Hedenskog had direct control and surveillance over was Tim McVeigh. And I will never forget this. I will never forget this as long as I live. This was in our second interview, and Chris told me. He said, "You know, Mike, I all the time that I spent with Tim McVeigh, as his handler and his overseer, I can tell you, you looked in that guy's eyes and you just saw nothing but blackness. I mean, just this icy cold stare of death. But, it was the first. He characterized it as being like the first time since the Gulf War that he was actually scared of something. It's like I look in that." Eyes, face, and it's just, man, you just see, you can feel the blackness in his soul.
That's wild when you think about, McVeigh freaking out about, the Death Alley kind of thing, like, seeing all the carnage, and that's never easy. That's not easy for anyone to see, but for him to now go against the government because of that, right? That's wild. Yet he has this darkness, right? That kind of darkness for someone to pick up. And that's such a weird vibe when you meet someone like that. That's cold. That's a real, like a psychopath, really. I think people are born that way. I don't think you can do anything about it. They're kind of born, like they say, rapists, cannot be, psychologically helped to get past what they've done to people and to prevent them to do it again. Like there's like a 95% chance of no rehabilitation. And there's certain killer, is it psychopaths that are like that? I'm not sure. But there's like definite, like certain kind of killers and people like that do it. But it's interesting how meticulous he was. And, he does all this, but it's in Oklahoma that he thinks he can get away with driving without a license plate. Hello. Like Oklahoma and Indiana are two states that will get you. They change the speed limit like all the time on one road within miles. I mean, it's like you have to be super vigilant on those highways. And so it's weird because I was like, when you said like a cop pulled him over, I'm like, maybe he knew, but he didn't. He didn't know. And so they bring him into custody over that. So do you think he wanted to get caught in a way?
No, I mean, I
As a
think.
suicide bomber, he wanted to be a suicide bomber, just like, God, look at September 11th. Suicide bombers are revered in some cultures, or groups,
I
I should
think,
say.
I think he, in a sense, he wanted to be, but he said to himself, and this is just me trying to piece together the different things that he's said and written about and trying to connect them with points of logic, was that he wanted to commit the crime, he wanted to get caught, he wanted to be executed, but somewhere among those three major points, he wanted people to listen to his story. And I think in his warped mind, he was telling himself, I really want everyone to know why I did what I did. And maybe they'll see that I was right all along and they'll, pick up arms and, come join me and I'll be the latter day martyr saint of,
That's what I was gonna say. Yeah, like a martyr. God, he almost sounds like bin Laden, man. Like, really, what's the difference? That's a domestic terrorist. We have him. So, would you say radicalization happens just with us? I know he's got like his few people that were part of, the terrorism and that attack. Of course, there's these militias, so there's others. But would you say on his own that that is radicalism, not just extremism, radicalism at that point.
Oh yeah, I mean it's about it. I think as far it's about as far off the deep end as you can go.
And it's weird when it's not such a huge group doing it. Like the Capitol building, that's still bad. That's horrible. All those things, right? But there's like a mob involved. So you kind of understand. I'm not saying I understand, right? Just saying that there's that mob emotional fury, rage kind of energy that can build, right? But when you're pretty much a solo person doing it, that's some crazy stuff. When it's on, you know what I mean? You're actually creating that energy yourself. That is worse to me in a way. You know, the mob thing is really crazy, but when one person is pretty much their own mob, that's creepy. That's really creepy. All of it's creepy, but that's creepy. So the moral of the story is speak up. Speak up. Even if you're wrong, better to be wrong than people be dead, you know? And this whole thing, I mean, our country's at odds and really fighting. And I think this is a timely conversation to remind people of how far and weird it can get. So hopefully this year, people. Let's not go there. Let's not go this far. Let's not go as far as the Capitol building. I mean, if, with the story, I mean, you're talking about, you know, gentlemen you interviewed. I mean, what do you think the general military response is to this with veterans? I mean, they had to be like, kind of like, dude, what the hell are you doing? You know, you know what I mean? This kind of thing. And even with the riot of the Capitol building, that's got to get the goat of veterans when it's their own soil that they fight for and this stuff happens.
I mean, I can tell you that there were no veterans at all who were thrilled or, even any bit praising of Tim McVeigh and what he did. And yeah, there's always that lingering fear of getting lumped into the same category as, whatever extremist out there that happens to do this or that. But, I think by and large, I can give American society credit for not defaulting to that lowest common denominator of thinking.
Good.
Because, my experiences both as a soldier on active duty and as a veteran, I can say that and I've never been mistreated for having worn the uniform. There's always been an outpouring of gratitude and good tidings for having served, and especially served during a time of war. So I think that by and large, Americans don't collectively go to that lower base level of thinking, but there's always the I think there's always the tacit fear among any of us veterans. It's like, well, gosh, we hope that this doesn't become a norm. Like, if more veterans start doing this, then they're going to start throwing us into the category. But I think, but I think by and large, by the time the Gulf War had ended, it was such a night and day difference from how veterans were being treated who came home from Vietnam, that I think the broader swaths of American society knew better than to act that way. And, to say nothing of the fact that it was an all-volunteer force at this point.
Okay, so can I ask a really, you know, I always have a dumb question, right?
Okay.
Well, come on, that's, you know, I know I'm not the only one out there either. I encourage dumb questions, send them. I would rather ask, like, just like we're saying, rather say something, right? With how we pulled out of Afghanistan. Okay, so I know, like, you know, when the Hussein was, you know, killed and everything, they dragged, you know, his statue and everything, and those were Marines from 29 Palms. Like, we did the interview with you while we were there too. Not when he was pulled out, not when he was killed, but Bin Laden getting killed, right? And all of that happened, so that a lot of times there's so many portions of like the war's over. And when we pulled out of Afghanistan recently, in the last few years, it was a really weird thing of how it was done, and everyone's kind of up and down about all of that. And but to me, it still felt like that the Desert Storm, the Gulf War was still kind of there with us still being in Afghanistan. It was like it was never really 100% done. And everything that's going on in the world right now, I don't think it's done. Like, honestly, I don't know. I mean, when do they say it's over? When do they say, okay, this war is completely done? We've talked about the Cold War before, and other podcasts. We were talking about this before we recorded this, but like some wars just never seem like they're done, even though maybe it is on the books. But you know what I mean? It's like even now when we look at Russia and Ukraine, and we look at Israel and Hamas and Palestine, like these seem to be wars that just kind of recycle themselves. It's not done. It's like, a family drama that never ends. A
Right.
family will still have that same beef. Obviously, wars like this is not like a family drama. Unless you come to my family. No, I'm kidding. But no, I'm kidding, really. But with Afghanistan, in a weird way, do you think that is, would you say it's all over? Like, when does that happen? Who says, like, okay, it's done? When we still had people in Afghanistan, and it still felt like we were there in this other's like way of building and protecting and keeping an eye out in a way. Like, to me, that's me. And I'm, not literate on any of this stuff, but that's how I feel. Like,
Yeah.
we just kind
Well,
of bailed out. Like, how, who's, and so now I feel like, oh, that's the end, but it's not now.
every war has its own metric for how the competing sides decide when it's over. And there are a lot of different factors that will officially go into it. In the school of classical warfare, generally the war was understood to be over when you captured the capital city. It was kind of like playing capture the flag. If you capture the flag, that's it. You're done. War's over. The other side has lost, and you have to accept the terms of surrender or try to negotiate some good terms of surrender. There was also this classical notion of you trade space for time, and that as you gain more ground against the enemy, the more ground that you get at the end of the conflict is what ultimately determines the winner. And then in other conflicts, it's not necessarily about gaining ground. It really becomes a war of attrition. You just try to bleed out the enemy's manpower to a point where they know that they can no longer continue on the war effort, and they have to, they have to accept whatever terms of surrender because they really just don't have the resources to carry on the fight anymore. I think for most of the 20th century, at least after World War II, it's been a little bit more nuanced. It gets to a point where you see a gridlock happening, where you see things come to a stalemate. And both sides go to some imaginary international judiciary force, if you want to use that, kind of like the UN or whatever. And they say, okay, well, let's try to broker a ceasefire, and let's broker a peace agreement, have this side give a little and that side give a little, and let's try to make a lasting peace treaty. But those are usually only as good as the willingness of both sides to abide by them.
It's like a band-aid.
Right. And then of
Yeah.
course, you do have other conflicts where, a government will formally surrender after, they've looked at what all the battle reports are, and they know that the enemy's closing in. But for something like Afghanistan, it was a bit nuanced from the beginning because we went in there, we knew who Bin Laden was, we knew he was the perpetrator, we knew we had to get him. That was the first measure of success, was we had to eliminate the people who masterminded this. We had to destroy, to the greatest extent possible, Al-Qaeda. But at the same time, we also were dealing with state actors in the form of the Taliban, because they were the ones who were, giving, aid and comfort, and they were essentially aiding and abetting the enemy. So we had to get them out of the picture too. Now, we suffered from something that a lot of experts will call mission creep, because we went in there to Afghanistan knowing, okay, we have to get bin Laden, kill Al Qaeda, kill the Taliban. But after meeting those three items, it became a question of, well, what else do we do? Do we build a democracy here in Afghanistan? Can a democracy work here? Because it hasn't for the better part of 2,000 years. And what does the security situation look like? How do we vet people to be part of this new government? What are they going to do? What are they not going to do in terms of becoming a more modern day nation? That's, I think, how we got our foot in the door there for the better part of 20 years, trying to figure out, okay, well, what is this new Afghanistan going to look like, and can it survive? Oh yeah, and by the way, we have to make sure that Afghanistan can stand on its own 2 feet after we leave. So, people tend to forget that the withdrawal timeline for Afghanistan started long before 2021. We at some point, I think after we killed bin Laden, and we started seriously thinking about, okay, well, how do we exit from Afghanistan? And yeah, the Taliban's hiding, they've gone into hiding. A lot of their leadership, and many of them have been killed, but a lot of them are still out there in the wilderness. So, can we withdraw? Can we have some kind of, peace treaty with the Taliban for them to, just accept the current ruling and maybe, take concessions here or there? Because we've been here for a while, and our original intent for coming here, bin Laden, he's now eliminated. So when and how do we pull out? But the thing is that there was never really going to be an easy or dignified way to get out of Afghanistan, just as a function of, the dynamics of the culture itself. I think the best thing for us to have done from the start would have just been to make the mission parameters very clear, not give way to any mission creep, and say, look, here's what we're here to do. We want to kill bin Laden, kill as many Al Qaeda operatives as we can, and kill as many Taliban as we can. And after items 1, 2, and 3 are met, okay, victory's been achieved. We're going to get out of here. And to all you Afghanis who are standing alive after the smoke clears, we're going to put a sign here to remind you, don't make trouble for us again, because if you pull this crap again like you did on 9/11, we're going to come back and we're going to kill even more of you. And really, when you look at it, wars get resolved in the best way possible when that message is made clear to the defeated party. It's like, okay, don't make trouble for us again, or we're going to come back and we're going to kill even more of you. Now, the Germans had to learn that lesson twice, but after 1945, they've been a reliable ally ever since. Yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, even now, I look at, I mean, we could talk all about that all day long about what's happening now. It's just, it's crazy as people, human beings, man. We got to get our stuff together. I'm just gonna say, I mean, people are dying over this and these kind of things, and there is retaliation that has to happen. At times, and also putting up defense. Defense is huge, and letting the defense be real and letting people know you have that immediate defense, right? That's a huge part too. And I think America showed up big time. You were part of that. Thank you. To say, hey, we're not letting you, it's so important. Like you're saying, being clear, being straight up, it goes back to the Tim McVeigh that we're Timothy McVeigh that we're talking about. There were signs, and sometimes you meet people, you go like, that feels really odd and weird, and you just ignore it, and then next thing you know, that's the person who killed somebody. Hello, let's not be that person in between. Let's say something somewhere, depending on where you are. And it's hard. I think sometimes we're not really set up for it. But like you said, after Columbine, we're getting better. We're getting better about communication. And hopefully, things don't have to be so overprotective. But I think we're getting to that point where the way the world is, we're going to have to be like that, even more vigilant, right? About everything. Eyes open, be aware, but not into hyper aware of like now you're going to join a militia. You don't need to do that. And I've listened to interviews where young girls in college get sucked into militias. It gets sucked into these rings, as like I said about a cult, because they're being more accepted and they didn't even realize this was, what it was about. Oh, you want better life for people. You want this, you want that. It all sounds beautiful until you found out that you said yes to all these things and it's a militia at the end of the rope. This carrot, 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 carrot. And then when you get to the end of the line and you're already trapped in, be aware, especially college students, it's happening at that level. It's happening in high school kids. It's happening. It really is. I'm not trying to be hyper, but I am. I'm like, be aware. And I think it's important for parents to be aware and for families to be aware if a family member or a friend, your friends are acting different than normal, to check it out, find out why, talk to them, put the phone down, and then maybe use the phone if you need to get help, right? That's what I'm saying. It's true. I mean, I don't know why we have so much of this now. I don't know if there's a human disconnect going on, but I kind of feel there is. And I don't know if all this technology puts that there. But, or aids it. I don't know. But I hope we have more connectivity as human beings so that we recognize signs, is my point. So, very cool conversation. Sad topic, but an awaring, an awaring, is that a word? Awaring makes me aware. So, yeah, a conversation of awareness. So, thank you, Mike, as always. Everyone, you can keep up with Mike at mikeguardia.com. His latest book, Fire in the Hole, Tales of Combat with the 1st Engineer Battalion in Vietnam, is available now. Go on Amazon, go on all the places you want to buy books. It's there. And it's an Amazon bestseller, right? For Vietnam War history?
It is.
Yeah, well, we know. We're not surprised. We're not surprised here. What's next, Mike?
All right. So, next we have Red Bandit, which is combat history of the MiG-29 and the forthcoming book on the spy war in Bosnia.
Dang. All right, man. We're looking forward to it. We're looking forward to next month. May, we're going to be talking about medics and nurses, right, in the military. We haven't covered that at all. So we're looking forward to that. So everyone stay tuned. Again, here on bigblendradio.com. Keep up with Mike at mikeguardia.com. Thanks so much, Mike.
Thank you, Lisa. Always a pleasure to be on the show.
Thank you for listening to Big Blend Radio's Military Monday show featuring Mike Guardia, award-winning author and historian. Keep up with Mike and his books at mikeguardia.com. Follow us at bigblendradio.com.